I am so excited about God's Word. I was thinking about an article I read from one of my, I'm an alum at Biola University in Southern Cal, and it was an article this week that just really strengthened once again my resolve to be all about God and His Word. And so much so that I thought, you know, it'd be awful nice if we became a people where we, with reflex, with a sort of an automatic impulse, whenever we were considering a difficult or complex or morally ambiguous situation, we quickly thought and defaulted to, what does God say? You know, where is God on this? That's a form of what I do every Sunday in a sermon, and we'll do again in just a moment. But I just wanted to encourage you that if you've got what God has to say, you've got all you need to go on, okay? I can't say it stronger. I don't know how except to tell you, if you're not rooted in God's Word, which means way more than hearing a sermon, you know, once a week or twice a month, it's an everyday thing. It's, God, tell me what you have to say about whatever. Finish my sentence. And He's got stuff to say. He hasn't stuttered. He's clear. And you can, here's the cool part. You become steady in a storm. It goes the other way, too. If you forget what God has to say, it's kind of like losing a tire on the freeway. That's hard to control, hard to drive that car. And so I want to encourage you that way, because this book is just so full of truth, and you'll see why I say that more this morning. I do want to take you back 3,000 years to when Israel was a united kingdom. The north and south hadn't existed at that point. They were united under two great kings, David and his son Solomon. And in those days, roughly spanning 80 years, David's reign 40, Solomon, his successor, another 40 years, Israel as a united nation was one powerful puppy. I mean, it was solid and it was steady. If you looked at Israel or had lived there in that day, you would have felt two things. You would have felt, wow, we've got a tremendous amount of military security. We are strong. We can stand against any foe. You would also have lived at a time in Israel when it was steady spiritually. There was a sense of God is with us, and what more could you want, right? I mean, what a great picture that I would love to have back again in our day. Near the end of Solomon's reign, Solomon began to see some of the slippage starting to take place. Morally, people weren't as precise in how they lived or made decisions. And Solomon talked to God about that, and he actually asked God, my paraphrase, if things go worse, if they go south from here, can you make a means for bringing us back, God, to this sweet spot that we live in today? Do I sound like a politician talking about a campaign in front of me? But it's really true. And Solomon said that. 2 Chronicles chapter 6 captures something of his plea. And God answered him and said, you know what? As a matter of fact, I will make a way for wanderers, my people, when they get far away from me, to return to me. And 2 Chronicles 7, verse 14, actually captures that way. It's been put to song. Maybe you've heard, if my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and turn from their wicked ways and seek my face, then I will hear their cry from heaven and I will forgive their sin and heal their land. Isn't that great? Actually, it turned out that that would be needed badly in the days to come. First and Second Kings, and we're in Second Kings chapter 6 this morning, but First and Second Kings is essentially the story of how Israel split in half, Israel now to the north, Judah to the south, and how pretty much the story unfolded and unraveled from there. Again and again, God would attempt to help and to heal and to restore his people, and that's all captured in these two books of the Bible. With monotonous repetition, God's people would stray, and they would sin, and they would somewhere along this downward spiral cry out to God for help. They sensed that they were going down the tubes, we would say. And crying out to God, he would send help and bring restoration and at least temporarily a blessing back to his people. That, by the way, I think is a pattern that exists today in our world. Maybe in some of the lives of people hearing me say that and sort of profile that on the front end here. So I asked you already or mentioned 2 Kings 6. I'd like you to turn there if you haven't found your way to page 256. If you don't have a Bible, there's one near you in a chair. And 2 Kings 6 takes us to where we left off 2 weeks ago. Last week, of course, being Easter Sunday. And 2 weeks ago, we were in this section of the story. Let me kind of remind you of a wonderful scene that took place. Israel was home to two prophets, Israel, the nation to the north. Prophet Elijah and his successor Elisha. Elijah was one that God used to perform some 8 miracles. Elisha, his successor, asked for a double portion, and he got what he asked for. God used him in some 16 miracles. And the study that we've been engaged with is about his life, Elisha's. What are lessons we can learn from him? Well, as a man of God, he had not a few who disliked him, probably for nothing more than that he sort of stood for fidelity. He stood for commitment to God. And Ben-Hadad was a neighboring king to the north in present-day Syria. In the day, it was called Aram, the nation of Aram, and they were the Arameans. Ben-Hadad had it in for Elisha, principally because Elisha was leaking military secrets to the king in the north, to Joram, the king of Israel. And every time Ben-Hadad had a plan and set a kind of a strike force of guerrilla fighters into Israel from Syria to attack some village or some city, it seemed like the people were waiting for him. And indeed, they were, because God had given Elisha wisdom, intelligence to be able to prepare the people, and they were able to thwart again and again these attacks. It left the king, King Ben-Hadad, terribly frustrated and gunning for Elisha. Elisha now is held up in a town 12 miles away from the capital, Samaria, in a town called Dothan. While he's in Dothan, the king finds out where he is, Ben-Hadad, and he sends a group to get him. We're gonna find this man, and we're going to do away with him, presumably to kill him. And they surrounded Dothan. And the next morning, the servant that was, we don't know his name, but he's alongside Elisha, he goes out. I sort of picture him early in the morning, he's yawning and stretching out on the porch. And when he did, everywhere he looked, he saw something that horrified him. The city, and indeed he and Elisha, were surrounded by an enemy. And he, verse 15 of chapter 6, tells us, my paraphrase, he freaked. We're going to die. We're all dead. There's a lot of them, and there's only 2 of us. We're goners, right? And that was the moment that time stood still for this unnamed servant. Elisha, however, remained calm, and he taught us a lot last time we were together about confidence in God in the midst of terribly ominous developments. Remember that? If you were here, you do. If you weren't, then go online and you can look up that sermon 2 weeks ago. But Elisha says, hey, wait, it's not as bad as you thought. Verse 16, don't be afraid. Those who are with us are more than those who are with them. And then he prays, Lord, open my servant's eyes. Let him see what I see. And then the Lord opened the servant's eyes. And I wish we had footage of this, because I guarantee you, he went from absolute, we're goners, to we got this. Because what did he see? He saw with his own eyes the hills full of horses and good guys, chariots of fire all around. And they way outnumbered the bad guys from Ben-Hadad and Aram. Does that sound a little bit like 1 John 4, verse 4? Greater is he who is in me than he who is in the world. I've never met my match, because I've got the ultimate God living, calling my heart his home. If you don't know Jesus, that's where it all starts. You've got to have him in your life. There's no covering for you. There is no protection. And indeed, you are outnumbered without him. So he asked for this. The prayer is answered. And the very next thing, the enemy advances. Because Ben-Hadad's guys, they didn't know that they were outnumbered. They didn't have eyes to see, but as they're approaching, they're blinded as a result of the prayer by the prophet, blind them, God, and they get up to the door, and he says, hey, guys, what are you here for? Well, I'll tell you what, this is the wrong place. I'll take you to that place, and he misleads them all the way down to Samaria, 12 miles away, and they literally come down Main Street in Samaria. Verses 18 and 19 tell us. And then something happened that you could absolutely guess. The king who lived there in the capital, in the palace, Joram, thought, are you kidding me? This is my opportunity to do away with the enemy. I'll kill them all. They've been harassing us, and they've been a burr in my saddle for a long time, and I'm done with it. I'm going to kill them all. And he prepares to do so. But Elisha then steps up and essentially says no, showing us the compassion. He had conviction and confidence in God, but then in verse 22, he shows compassion. Don't kill them. Would you kill those you've captured with your own sword or bow? No, do something different. Let's change it up. Feed them. Give them something to drink. And then when they've been satisfied, they'll go home with this most unbelievable story to their master, we're told at verse 22. So he prepared a great feast for them, and after they had finished eating and drinking, he sent them on their way, and they returned to their master. And verse 23 ends in a most unexpected way. They stopped messing with Israel. They quit bothering Israel. That's straight out of Proverbs 16:7, which says, when the Lord takes pleasure in anyone's way, he causes his enemies to be at peace with him. Elisha was walking with God, and as a result, God caused his enemies to be at peace. That's how verse 23 ends. The raiding of Israel with these little sort of band of guerrillas ended. But verse 24 changes everything with three words, sometime later. Now, we're not told how much time transpired between verse 23 and 24. Most believe, and I think it's a fairly accurate one, that it's probably a span of a few years. Long enough for Aram and their king, Ben-Hadad, to have forgotten the kindness shown. They could have all been killed. Long enough for them to forget all about that. And in this case, verse 24 says, Ben-Hadad mobilized not just a few in these small little groups, the bands from Aram. He mobilized his entire army and marched up and lay siege to Samaria. All right. What does that mean? Lay siege is a kind of an ancient military expression for describing surrounding and completely sealing off a city. In this case, it was Samaria, the capital. So this vast army comes, this time to seal off the city. It's airtight, which means this: no one gets in and nothing gets in or out of the city. You say, well, how's that a big deal? Well, when that goes on day after day and month after month, and we're not told how long, but for a very long time, some really scary things start to happen inside the walls of that city. Picture Tigard, even if you don't live here, or Sherwood, whatever town, okay? Imagine it being completely surrounded, and it's not long before, maybe days, the shelves on every store in that city are empty. They're barren. Go walk into any store. In fact, they're unlocked now. It's no big deal because there's nothing in there to eat or drink. Gone. And now picture backyard gardens that are scattered throughout the little town, or in this case, Samaria, this city. Backyard gardens have been completely picked clean of anything edible. What's left? Oh, livestock. Well, we've already killed and eaten those because that was necessary some time ago. All you got is little animals, pets we call them, and those too are killed and consumed. All the while, desperation starting to descend upon the people. Okay? You say, wow, you got a lot out of verse 24. It's true. But that's what siege meant here. And desperation leads to unthinkable outcomes. Mass starvation was imminent. It wasn't a few weak ones off in the sort of fringes. It was all of us are going down. That was what began to sort of weigh like a wet blanket on the people, which gives way to an unthinkably barbaric survival idea, cannibalism. If you have little people, you might explain this a little more detailed later, but verse 25, there was a great famine in the city. The siege lasted so long that a donkey's head sold for 80 shekels of silver. More on that in a moment. And a quarter of a cab of seed pod for 5 shekels. To you and me, that's nothing. That's saying that a donkey's head cost a bag of silver. It had that much value in these desperate times. And this quarter of a cab of seed pods, very few little crumbles of seed for a substantial amount of silver. 5 shekels. As the king of Israel was passing by on the wall, a woman cried out to him, "Help me, my lord the king." And I would try to do it in the tone that Hebrew captures here, but it's horrible. She's in a full-blown panic. Then the king replied, "If the Lord doesn't help you, what can I do for you? From the threshing floor? From the wine press? Nothing. There's nothing to thresh anymore. There's no grapes to crush and create something drinkable from." Then he asked her, "What's the matter?" She answered, "This woman," presumably standing next to her and perhaps even pointing to her, "said to me, 'Give up your son so we may eat him today, and tomorrow we'll eat my son.' And so we cooked my son and ate him." This is hard to read. This is awful. "The next day I said to her, 'Give up your son, it's your turn, so we may eat him.' But she has hidden him." This, of course, a ravenous hunger had taken over. As I mentioned, making the unthinkable actually seem like a temporary solution. By the way, if you were Hebrew, you would appreciate what has been said, and the thing that would have tripped you up just as much as eating human would be eating a donkey's head, because donkey was a forbidden food. It was completely unkosher. It was like close to poison. You'd rather almost die than eat it, if you were a Hebrew, and these people were. So they're paying fortunes for a piece of forbidden food, to say nothing, and we We read it already, but the seed pods, those are the quarter of a cab. Some of your footnotes at the bottom will reveal this as well. It's actually a reference to dove dung. They literally went and harvested bird droppings to take the seeds out of them. And what possible nutrition could be found there? But they were willing to part with a substantial amount of money just to have that. So hearing this caused a reaction in the king. Verse 30 tells us that he was outraged. He gets up and he tears his robe and he went along the wall, and the people looked and they saw that he had torn his robe, and under his robe was his sackcloth on his body, a sure sign of great vexation, terrible trauma the king was shouldering as the one in charge of the city. Who did he blame? It had been nice if he had blamed himself. At least it would have been honest. But he blames instead God. That's his point there. And if you didn't catch it earlier, catch it in the words that end verse or chapter 7. The disaster that we're experiencing is from the Lord. Do you see that? There's no mistaking that. But he's not done blaming. He blames God for what they're going through. And next he blames Elisha in making him responsible for it. In these words in verse 31, may God deal with me, be it ever so severely, if the head of Elisha, son of Shaphat, remains on his shoulders today. I'm going to get you, Elisha. Question. Why Elisha? What did he do? How is he responsible for this? Well, the truth is, he was an easy target. He was a God guy. He was somebody known to be connected to the one true God, Yahweh, the Creator God. It happened in Jesus' day this exact same way. This is the way Jesus put it in John chapter 3. This is the verdict, Jesus said. Light has come into the world, but people love darkness instead of light because their deeds were evil. Everyone, he says, everyone who does evil is indifferent to the light? No. Hates the light. You ever been someplace and they found out that you were a Christian and suddenly the conversation took on a different dynamic? It got awkward. If you were a pastor, you'd have this experience frequently. It's like, first of all, people are confessing their sins freely to you. You know, like, oh, you know, I mean, this just happened at an RV show recently, and I was talking to a guy that we look for every time we go to this show, and he's got quite a mouth on him, and I love this guy. He's a great guy. It's one of the highlights of the show, but he's just got a sailor's, you know, talk, and he's just waxing away, you know, and blah, 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 you know, about different things. And he goes, hey, man, he goes, so what do you do anyway? All these years, I never asked you what you do, you know? I go, I'm a pastor. Oh, you could just, I mean, he's just going crazy, and he gives me this big hug, like, you know, oh my gosh, you're my pastor. I go, well, not yet, bro, not yet, you know. Just a great moment. Oh, I'm a pastor. And I mean, this guy just about had a baby through his nostril. He was so. So it happens that way. And it happened that way here. I don't think Elisha did anything that Joram could say, you're the reason this happened. But he was gunning for him. So he sends out a posse to go get him. And verse 33 tells us, Elisha said, no, delay the messenger that came to find me, knowing that the king would follow soon. And that's exactly what happened. The king says after coming, this disaster is from the Lord. Why should I wait for the Lord any longer? You ever been in a situation like that? Or maybe today you're in it. Waiting's hard. I don't care if you're single, waiting for a husband or a wife. I don't care if you're sick, waiting for some kind of resolution or solution. If you're you're now counting in years how long you've prayed for somebody that just is hard-hearted to Jesus. They don't care about him. In fact, you feel a little bit. There are times when they sort of throw you under the bus and you didn't do anything except pray for him. Waiting's a difficult process. You wait, you hope, you pray, and you hang in there in the midst, maybe not a famine like this, but unbearable circumstances. Your job's not easy for you. Your health, your marriage is miserable. I don't know if I'm touching on one that you know or you know somebody going through, but in those times, it's really hard. And then you almost feel sometimes when you can hardly stand it any longer, wham, it gets worse. And you're like, what's up? And maybe you felt at times, strangely, an allegiance or at least a rapport with this king who says, I'm done waiting. Why should I wait any longer? Am I describing you? Well, why? What's the use? In fact, if it's going to get better, I got a new insight. It's up to me. How come I know this so well? I've just now described myself. I hope this doesn't make you nervous. I'm not describing me 30 years ago. I struggle with this all the time. Because I'm with people who need a miracle. I'm with people who are considering cannibalism. And I have to say to them, I'm not sure I'm able to live this out all the time myself, but waiting on the Lord's the only way to do this. It's the only way to survive. I want to tell you in the same terms, you know, David said it in Psalm 40, it's going to be read for you in the worship team. You know, waiting's a hard thing to do. Don't give up. The way out of your situation, the way through it, the way past your problems is oftentimes at the last possible moment. I could preach a whole nother sermon on a guess. Why? Why does God wait? Why does his idea of waiting and mine rarely line up? I just know God, Isaiah 9 verse 6 says God's a hero God. He describes himself that way. I'm a hero. And what does a hero do? One thing I know about a hero, they come through when? Just in the nick of time, right? And when it was in baseball terms, a hero doesn't step up to the plate in the first inning and knock one over the fence. Everybody screams wildly and yay, yay, yay. But by the end of the game, in 2 hours, or baseball lasts 4 hours or something, at the end of the game, you've forgotten about this guy in the first inning. A hero happens when it's ninth inning. It's only a nine-inning game if you don't know baseball. And it's the bottom half of the ninth inning. Oh, and it's two outs. You only get three. And that batter is now up to the plate. And the count on him is 3 balls and 2 strikes. And a pitch comes and he knocks it out of the park. And they win the game. That's why Kurt Gibson comes to mind. Different. That's what made it immortalized. And that's the God the Bible tells us about. So whatever you're waiting for, it could be bottom of the ninth when he comes through. And resist, please. Resist the temptation to think he's forgotten about you. He's got bigger fish to fry, not me. I'm a little guy. Don't believe that. Can you hear me talking to me? That's what I mean. Let's not go there. Everything changes in verse 1 of chapter 7. Elisha replied to this king that says, I'm done waiting. hear the word of the Lord. This is what the Lord says. About this time tomorrow, a seah of the finest flour will sell for a shekel, and two seahs of barley for a shekel at the gate of Samaria. Okay, again, you just read words that you're like, what's that? It means the same city 24 hours earlier, right now, when these words were spoken, you would pay all that you have saved for a donkey's head. By tomorrow, 24 hours later, there will be such an abundance of food for a feast, you might pull out a quarter. That's how fast it would change in 24 hours. People hearing this, including the officer named in verse 2, can't believe their ears. So he says to Elisha, look, come on, really? Are you joking? Even if the Lord should open the floodgates of heaven, could this happen? What he's saying here is we're in such a spot, there isn't enough supply in heaven itself to help us. And Elisha responds, you will see it with your own eyes, but don't forget these words. You will not eat any of it. God will come through. He's telling us here by tomorrow. Are you seeing the showdown going on here? One of these two is right. And in 24 hours, you're going to find out who. One of these two is wrong. A friend of mine quipped, talk about working without a net. That's the prophet here. He's landed on the line. Here's the deal. Either goes my way or it doesn't, and I'm hosed. I'm declared to be a fraud. Twice he says, the word of the Lord, verse 1. And this is what the Lord says. He has confidence in his voice. Do you have that kind of confidence in God? Hope you do. Let me just reach into the gospel itself. What is the gospel? We call it the gospel. It's the good news. There's four statements that make up the gospel. And actually, the first one, that good news, starts with bad news. All have sinned. Romans 3:23 says. That's inclusive and it's universal, including this present company. There's some really nice people here, but you're all sinners. And the guy saying that is a sinner. That's the first point. The second point is that if you sin, all who sin are under God's deserved wrath. That means unless you find a remedy, you will face judgment by a holy God and it will not turn out well for you, says Romans 6:23. The wages of sin is death. Third point, it's really the point that changes the expression on the person's face that you share this with. God, through his son Jesus, took your place on a cross and received on himself the wrath that was due you. And people go, seriously, really? That's too amazing. Oh yeah, it's called amazing grace. How can it be that thou, my God, would die for me? Fourth point, you can't just hear that and be all kind of good. There, it took care of me. I guess I'm in, right? Because he died for all. You must respond. Three of those four points that make up the gospel are not easy to tell people. You've sinned. You deserve damnation forever because of your sin. And you must respond. That one, they'll step forward on. How confident are you in talking to people about stuff like that? Now, back in 2 Kings 7, things happen next, much as you would expect, but there's a few really standout kind of ironies, twists, I would call them. Let's read a big section here and just appreciate them, and we'll be done. Now, there were four men with leprosy, verse 3 tells us, at the entrance of the city gate. So notice this. If the gate's right here, they're just outside the gate for reasons you'll appreciate in a moment. If we say, we'll go into the city, this is what these lepers are saying to themselves. If we go into the city, the famine is there and we will die. I love their logic here. okay? We're in a bad spot. We got leprosy. But if we go into the city, we're really dead, okay? And if we stay here, we're going to die too. Their logic is so wonderful and it's refreshing. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to go over to the camp. Let's go over to the camp of the Arameans, the enemy, and surrender. Because it's like flipping a coin. It could go either way. We may live, or they might kill us and then we die. That's just refreshing. It's a sermon in about 12 seconds, right? So at dusk, they get up. They decide on the third option. They get up and they go to the camp of the Arameans. When they reach the edge of the camp, they get shot full of holes. That may have happened if someone was there. You're going to love this. No one was there, for the Lord had caused. You got to appreciate this. This is an ancient form of audio, the new kind of technology in warfare, that blasting him with scary sounds. Well, you're reading it here first. For the Lord had caused the Arameans to hear the sound of chariots and horses and a great army, so that they said to one another, "Oh, my stars!" They probably didn't say it quite that nice. "Look, the king of Israel's hired the Hittites and the Egyptian kings to attack us." Meaning, this surrounded city, somehow they got word out that they're about to die and there's reinforcements coming. So they got up, these hardened soldiers from Aram, they get up and they fled in the dusk and abandoned their tents and their horses and their donkeys, and they left camp as it was and ran for their lives. This is shocking. Meanwhile, the men who had leprosy reached the edge of the camp. "Hello? Anybody home?" And entered one of the tents. And they did what you do when you're starving and when you see food and wine for the first time in a long, long time. They scavenged, they ate and drank. And then, hey, while they're at it, they took silver and gold and clothes. And they went off and they did what I would have done. They hid it. And then they came back and returned to another tent and took some things from it, and they hid that also. And this thing keeps going like this. It's really cool. They say to each other, "Whoa, wait a minute. What we're doing is not right. This is a day of good news, and we're keeping it to ourselves. If we wait until daylight, punishment will overtake us. We got to go at once and report this to the royal palace back in the city." So they went and called out to one of the city gatekeepers and told him, "We went into the Aramean camp. You're not going to believe this. And no one was there. Not a sound of anyone. Only tethered horses and donkeys. Ugh. And the tents left just as they were." The gatekeeper shouted the news. There's no phones to pick up. They shouted it and it was reported within the palace that God had routed the enemy. Picture this scene. You don't need any help doing so. These guys run for their lives. The shocker, they were hearing things. There was no one there. No enemy coming. No imminent threat. Just in a full-blown panic. Look at the word in verse 15. It's a really cool word that explains this even more, because they gave chase later and found all kinds of their stuff strewn on the path heading north back home where these soldiers came from. And it says the equipment the Arameans had thrown away in the headlong, see that word, headlong flight? It's a word being used for reckless haste. Just get out of my way. Coming through. As they're heading home. I just think this is so cool. And they are such lousy soldiers. It's unbelievable. I mean, seriously, you're a hardened soldier. You're like, I mean, this is a throwback to the Iraqi Revolutionary Guard. Blah, blah, blah. That lasted about 12 hours. I mean, give me a break. Fact, remember the pictures we saw out of there? They had abandoned everything. All the way on the road from Baghdad to some other place. Now let me remind you of something. The king of Israel had given up, verse 33 of chapter 6 tells us. He had given up on God. Now less than a day later, God was coming through. Got to tell you, I think that happens. And God uses lepers of all people. Someone called them the bottom feeders of society. So complete was their abandon. They've got some amazing options. I mean, I was in Walmart yesterday down in Sherwood. And there's a lot of people there, more than there should be. Really. Seriously, y'all need to be in Walmart at one time, you know. And I'm in there, and I'm like, excuse me, sir, pardon me, get out of my way. And I get up to the check stand. And, you know, every checker's got 12 people in line. And I thought, are you kidding me? And I went down, and they have the self-checkout. And I got it done. With some help, I got it done. I thought of this passage, and it was on my mind, actually. And I thought, imagine walking into Walmart. It's empty. No one around. All the shelves full. It's all yours. In fact, the front door is wide open. Hello? You know what? I'd go first to the RV section and get a bunch of supplies there. Now I'd get another basket and I'd go to the grocery section. And I would just enjoy myself. Starving? You better believe it. So would you. Oh, that's not right. Well, if you're starving, right goes out the window, let me tell you. It's not right, but it happens. That's how it would have been. And they did it exactly that way, but get this. Something happened in verse 9. Something happened. I slowed down long enough hoping you got it, like it hit me and knocked me over while I'm pilfering the shelves at Walmart. I read, what we're doing is not right. It's the day of good news, and we're keeping it to ourselves. There's a word for that. Conscience. This is crazy. We can't do this. It's a violation of who God is. So these lepers make up their mind to go before daylight. That's what verse 9 goes on to say. They return quickly. Go at once. Is this verse in our Bibles not recorded to impact people like me and you today? I think it is. We have the gospel, the good news. Our lives, my life has been spared because of Jesus giving his life. 1 Corinthians 15:3 is the shortest summary of the gospel. Four words. Christ died for me. 2 Corinthians 5, verse 15 says, and there's an implication to that. Christ died for you so that you should no longer live for yourself, Steve, but for him who died and rose again. Amen? That should change everything. I'm going to just submit to you, if it's not changing some or most of you, something's in the way. It's likely sin. But it's not just ours to enjoy and hide it from the rest. Every human on this planet has been infected with a deadly disease. And a few have found the cure. Is that not the gospel? I know that sometimes people with the deadly disease do hurtful things to you or to me. And honestly, it tempts me to be indifferent to their terminal condition. Hey, well, you gonna hate me? See how that works for you. Don't stay there. I know you have those moments like I do. We're human. The only difference between you and them is that you've been cured. If you belong to Christ. Like these lepers, you're one beggar telling another beggar where to find food. So tell it every time you can to everyone you can. That's the idea here. If you feel a stab in your heart, the Holy Spirit's talking to you like he is me. You can't force feed people, let me remind you. You cannot. Our job, and it's the right thing, is to simply convey, I found food. Let God do the convincing. So they return to the city and share this unbelievable news. And of course, the king doesn't buy it. He's suspicious. Verse 12 tells us, it's like, seriously, this sounds like a setup. So the courageous king decides he's going to send some guys out to check it out. That's called a suicide mission. Because if they come back, then I guess it's true. If they don't, well, so be it. And they do. They go out and they check it out. And amazingly, it turns out to be true. And it ends with these last four verses that are important to read. See, if you don't, go back to the beginning of this message when you read how this chapter ends. It's no accident it ends with these details. Then the people went out and plundered the camp of the Arameans. So a seah of the finest flour sold for a shekel. Remember those words? And two seahs of barley sold for a shekel, as the Lord had said. Circle those words. Now the king had put the officer on whose arm he leaned in charge of the gate, and the people trampled him in the gateway. And he died. Remember verse 2. We already spent time there. You will see it, but you won't taste it. Just as the man of God had foretold when the king came down to his house. It happened as the man of God had said to the king, about this time tomorrow. It's a throwback to verse 1. About this time tomorrow, a seah of finest flour will sell for a couple of pennies, and two seahs of barley for a shekel at the gate of Samaria. The officer had said to the man of God, look, even if the Lord should open the floodgates of heaven, could this happen? Every word here is repeated on purpose. The man of God replied, you will see it with your own eyes, but you will not see, you will not eat any of it. And that's, he adds in verse 20, an editorial punctuation point. That's exactly what happened to him, for the people trampled him to death in the gateway. Boy. God uses lepers to save the city. I hope this did a lot to get rid of the idea that God has a very selective few that he can use. It's just not true. I'd like you to bow your heads with me. Word for word, God, you worked out this situation. I thank you for it. There was plentiful food. An officer refused to believe that it would happen. The prophet's prediction that the officer would see it but not taste the food, it all happened exactly as you said, because your ways work exactly the way you say. Sometimes surprisingly, Lord, but you come through. I want to invite you in a few moments to come to the tables for communion. And when you do, I want you to leave something there. I want you to leave that situation, that burden, the thing you're exhausted in waiting over. I want you to leave it at the table. And I want you to take the bread and the cup back to your seat. Join the worship team for some worship and song. And remember these words as you do. There is no situation so chaotic that God cannot, from that situation, create something that is surpassingly good. He did it at creation. He did it again at the cross. And he's doing it still. Let's respond to him now.